R. Brunk the first. George R. Brunk was living in the same time era as Daniel Kaufman. And they both were men, I believe, that were very like-minded. Both of them wanted to see a church that believed in true doctrine. And both of them wanted to see the church living for the Lord faithfully. And they saw too many people that were headed into apostasy. Though they were kind of like-minded, I believe they both thought they were doing what was right, but George R. probably came out a little bit of the stronger of the two, and it was probably because of his characteristic. Brother George R., I would say, finished what Daniel Kaufman started. Daniel Kaufman made sure to tie the strings, the loose strings of doctrine, to make sure that they were right. George R. Brunk came along and made sure everything was double knotted. So, in his youth, or as a child, his father died and it left his mother a widow. They lived in Missouri. His mother was remarried. And as a young boy of 17, he took over his mother's farm. And within 4 years, he had paid all her back debts. He was living there alone. I'm going to read to you what he says about his youthful years. He says, "My first ideal when I grew up in my teens was to be a cowboy like some of my schoolmates who went to Texas and tamed bucking broncos. I was defeated in that because of an enlarged conscience and a mother who could pray and cry. After I was grown to manhood size, Abraham Lincoln, who was living at that time, was my hero. He was a great lawyer, wore a long black coat, and took up his pen one day and wrote a declaration that set 4 million people free. I wanted to be great and noble. My next hero was a Christian minister, J.S. Kaufman, whom I was providently forced to hear when I was young. I can always see him standing in our schoolhouse where there was a crowd of grinning, foolish young people with his arms extended, with the kind words and the pleading expressions on his face. Under him, I gave my life for Christ. God, for Jesus' sake, forgave my sins and directed my course in life." And so that made all the difference. He gave his life to the Lord. Now, I don't exactly have the exact age that he was, whether that was before or after, during the time of his time of living alone on his mother's farm and farming by himself. But at the age of 22, he was not married. He was ordained a minister of the gospel. Throughout his life, he did not like to be called reverend, and so he would make sure to put after his name VDM, Minister of the Word of God. It was Latin for Minister of the Word of God. And he was known to be a scholar. He was so wrapped up in his studies at night that he would not quit studying. He would study throughout the night, and he would get to the time he felt that it was time to retire, and he would finally go to bed, only to hear the cock crow, because it was morning already. Daniel Kaufman wrote of him, "He was possessed with more than ordinary natural ability. He had early formed the habit of extensive reading, both biblical and of things pertaining to man. No sooner had he gotten into active service for the Lord than he became a champion of the conservative faith. George R. believed in maintaining a disciplined church. And he was no loner. He would go from church meeting to church meeting, attending all kinds of meetings. At the age of 27, he was ordained bishop. And about a year and a half later, after he was ordained bishop, he was holding meetings in Virginia, and he saw a young lady get up from where she was sitting and go over to the water cooler to get a drink, and he leaned over to the minister beside him and asked who she was. And the minister told him, and he thought to himself, "Well, that's the lady for me." And 3 months later, he was married to Katie Wenger, who was a sister of A.D. Wenger. And George and Katie had 9 children. I'm going to read to you a little bit what kind of, just tell you what kind of father he was. He was very instructive to his children. And before his children were very old, he thought he was going to die. They thought he was going to die. And the doctor said it was because he spent too much time studying and not enough time sleeping. So, you know, if we spend too much time studying, we should take a warning. Make sure you get your sleep. But he was a gentle father, his children said, but also very strict. He wrote a letter to his firstborn, Esther, when he thought he was going to die. And he said, "Dear Esther, you are our firstborn. Upon you was lavished the first full measure of our parental love. You will never know the tender depths of that love or the conflict of hopes and fears that swept it." And he tells her, "Be patient, kind, and helpful to your brothers and sisters." But to another daughter, he wrote this: "I wish you would plan to come home. We would never forgive ourselves if your religious life would be broken or your faith weakened. You must not think hard of us if we try to keep you from selling your birthright for a mess of pottage. You should be true to your home and church vows. We are anxious for you to conform to the church standards here. Get another bonnet, get those skirts let out, and be an example of modesty and reserve as becomes a Christian, and especially a Mennonite bishop's daughter." So he could be pretty stern with his children. But after his death, they did write. One of them wrote, "As a father, he showed us all tender love. From childhood, we were dedicated to God. As the children came into the home, he would pray that if God in his wisdom and foreknowledge would see that any of us would miss the way, he should in mercy take the child in its innocency." Another wrote, "One thing outstanding in the character of father was that, combined with his stern qualities, there was also a gentleness and tenderness and sympathy to such a degree that one rarely finds coupled in the same individual." And George R. was living in the Midwest for about 10 years after he was married. But he began to get concerned about this, about Goshen College, and he made sure the people in the Midwest knew that Goshen College was headed to disaster. And so he decided that the people in the East didn't know that, and so he moved east. And that's where he ended up living the rest of his life, and was in the East, telling people with sharp words and a sharp tongue what he thought Christian, or how he thought Christians ought to live. He is known because of those sharp words sometimes in his tongue. But Sanford Shetler said, "Would you rather have someone with sharp words or a sharp tongue? Or how long would you go to a store where the owner of the store used a 35-inch yardstick or measured your weights by a 15-ounce pound, even if he had a lot of love? Would you continue going to him?" Well, probably not. So he said, "Go to someone that tells the truth, like George R. Brunk." Early in George's ministry, he began to write. And he wrote very widely. And as time moved on, he began to feel the need for more writing that would dogmatically attack the liberalism in the church. And so he took on in 1929, printing The Sword and Trumpet. And in that he wrote widely against a lot of practices of the church. He wrote against the tobacco usage in the church, made sure people knew that tobacco was wrong. And in a measure he was able to help send tobacco on the way out of the conservative Mennonite church. Another thing that he saw that Mennonites did in his day was wore black bow ties. And he said, "There is no need for bow ties in the church." So he made sure to use his pen and let everyone know that bow ties should not be worn. There's no need for a bow tie. And with his influence, many, many Mennonites dropped the bow tie. He also did a lot to warn against alcoholism. He was concerned lest the church should follow a lukewarm Christendom. He wanted sound churches and sound schools. He even was instrumental in starting Eastern Mennonite College, and in his day, Eastern Mennonite College stayed conservative. He was instrumental in helping make a standard that said these bylaws will never be changed. Well, once men like him are gone, they did get changed. I'm going to read to you the poem that he put in the first issue of The Sword and Trumpet. This shows you his heart, as well as you'll see that the church then was similar to today. Looseness. This is an age of looseness and crime. From the heathen debased to the rich of the time, the tendency strong in church and the state is to go where you please and leave open the gate. It may be that old Dobbin, quite stiff in his knees, will stand in the park, though not tied to the trees. And Spitfire the colt will never be tame. That will never be tame, has broken six halters and made himself lame. But will this be excuse to throw halters away, to let each horse decide where to go or to stay? Then why do men fight against law and good rules, for guidance of wise and restraining of fools? For horses or men, there is only one hope. If they break their restrictions, just double the rope. And if the good laws are wisely applied, they may learn how to stand without being tied. I dislike to see boys not high as your shoulder that know 10 times more than persons much older. And when father and mother lay down some restrictions, get pouty and sullen and begin to cause friction. I never saw master or miss such a saint but that they were bettered by parents' restraint. For many a one to the gallows has come for want of a law and a rod in the home. And then when it comes to the laws of the land, so many thus tied will not even stand. Some men for a dollar will take a man's wife, or cheat him in trading, or marry his wife, or steal from his neighbor his chains or his axes, or give him short measure, or be dodging his taxes. But in spite of law breaking, there is not a man, not constantly helped by the laws of the land. In matters of church, we know very well, no law of itself can save one from hell. Yet by heeding laws, a man's ways are made clean, and pitfalls avoided that he never had seen. The flesh can be checked and the conscience alarmed, and evil surpassed by which others are harmed. By law a man is brought on this side the grave to the point where the word and the spirit can save. Now if children are wiser than matron or sire, and safely can play with poison and fire, and loungers in stores with soapbox for stool know better than Congress how nations to rule, and the wisdom of God in one single brother is greater than Bible and conference together, then nail up the church. Lay the book on the shelf and let every man be a law to himself. If opposers of law just only could see, they are cutting a limb twixt themselves and the tree. And if they succeed, they not only will fall, but down will come home, church, nation, and all. If men want no law but their own precious will, let them herd with the bushmen till they get their fill. I think one such year would certainly end it. They would favor God's law and forever defend it. George R. Brunk, Sr. Just a few incidents from his life yet. Once when Brother Brunk had been speaking words of comfort to a brother ill in an open ward in a hospital, he turned to another man on a bed nearby and asked of the state of his soul. The man, reflecting his Calvinist teaching, roughly replied, "If God wants me, let him come and get me." "Listen," said Brother Brunk, "if you don't concern yourself about your soul's salvation and do something about it, somebody will come and get you, and it won't be God either." So oftentimes he would defend his Mennonite beliefs and values, and sometimes he would say it in a witty way. Once a Baptist friend visiting in the Mennonite community commented on the beautiful farms and orchards, that they were fine-looking and bountiful. And he said, "It seems the Lord shows special favor to you Mennonites." "Not so," said Brother Brunk. "But you Calvinists are trying to raise crops on faith only, while we believe and practice a proper combination of faith and works." Brother Brunk was also known for coining words. You know, people that are well known frequently get recognized by words they coin. He's known for coining two words or phrases. One is fractional gospel, and the other is laxitarian. One day, a woman in the market told George Brunk that she fasts before communion in the Catholic Church so that when she partakes of communion, she gets more of Christ. Because the Catholics believe that when they partake of communion, those sacrament emblems turn into Christ's body and blood and goes into their body and becomes more of Christ in them. But Brother Brunk said, that's where the Catholics differ from the Mennonites. We take Christ into our hearts, not into our stomachs. Well, George R. Brunk didn't die in 1917 when they thought he was going to. And again later, when his children were a little bit more grown, he didn't die. Both times he prayed that he would live longer. Well, the third time he got sick, he said, I'm not going to pray. I'm not going to ask the Lord to save my life. And yet the Lord saved him. But a little while later, George Brunk actually died milking the cow. They found him out. I don't know if he was still milking the cow. I think that he was carrying the milk back to the house, but he was still inside the barn. And he died. The Lord took him suddenly. Why? Well, probably so that he didn't have to get sick and pray that he'd not die. The Lord took him suddenly. You know, still today, words that he has spoken so many years ago have benefited people and still stir people's hearts. What are we doing today that will outlast us?
How many of you have heard of Pablo Yoder? Okay, most of you have. How many of you have heard of Noah Kime? Okay, Noah Kime was actually the bishop of the church when Pablo Yoder was a little boy. And I'd like to, I had the privilege of knowing Noah in his later years, but I'd like to just tell you a little bit about Noah Kime. Noah Kime was born in Ohio, actually was a part of the Amish church there in Ohio. And in 1947, he served as the Amish representative for the Lakeside Christian Day School, which was close to Hartville, Ohio. It's still operating today. And he was ordained in the Amish church in 1951. They were the first Amish to have a written record of their faith and practice instead of just the oral tradition. In 1955, Noah and his family moved to Stuart Straff, Virginia. And 2 years later, they moved to Madison County, Virginia, which is where he was bishop and spent the rest of his life. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Mountain View Nursing Home. You heard of Mountain View Nursing Home? Okay, a number of you. Mountain View Nursing Home is in that community, was actually started in 1962, in those early years, and while Noah Kime was serving as bishop there of the local church. And it's still operating today, and there have been thousands of people over 1,000, that have served there, and some in their 1W service, some later on as volunteers. Some of the things that changed when they moved to Madison County is they started preaching in English because of the visitors that they had in church that couldn't understand German. And that was something that was fairly unique for that time in those churches. Noah was once asked by some some men on whether it had been hard to live as an Amish person. And his reply was, indeed it had not been. There was never a better way of life than that lived by the Ohio Amish who live by scriptural principles. And those last couple words are the key, if we're living by scriptural principles or not. Noah spent a couple years serving as a representative from the Amish Mennonite churches to the Peace Problem Committee of the Mennonite Church until he concluded that the committee was not working on solutions that were compatible with the vision of the church he represented. In 1959, Noah Keim, along with Sanford Yoder, were appointed as the first school board there. Now, Sanford Yoder was ordained by Noah Keim, which Sanford is Pablo's dad. And so he was ordained there in the church as well. And they started it was called the Madison Christian Day School. Today it's called the Oak Grove Mennonite School. And several of my children went there to school after we moved to Virginia, and I actually had the privilege of teaching there for several years as well. One of the things that were happening in those days, there were various mission outreaches that were happening. There were people that were moved out of the Shenandoah Mountains because of the Shenandoah National Park coming in. And so they moved a lot of people out of the park area and built little houses for them and things and had them live there. And the church there had established some mission churches in some of those areas as well. One of those areas was over in the Free Union Faith Mission area. And how many of you boys have read Home on the Rock Pile? Okay. That was that area where that happened. That was a mission church plant from the church that Noah Keim was bishop. And then Sanford's ended up moving over there then. And shortly after that, Faith Mission Home started, that's still operating today as well. As you think about, you know, all the things that have happened, one of the things that the people in our community there remember a lot is as Noah Keim retired, he would often stop by and take boys along with him fishing. He would often go fishing at the local ponds, and it was a pretty a normal, almost weekly occurrence that he'd take somebody fishing of the boys in church. And you know, as you think about the opportunities that you have to be an influence on others, you know, sometimes it may be in a more public way, where in his case at times he was the bishop there, other times it was just picking up a boy and taking him fishing. But all of those things have a way of influencing others. And I'd like to encourage each of us to look for those kind of opportunities of ways that we can help be an influence on other people.
Twenty-two years ago, my dad was the same age I am. And I think about my short life, and I think, what effect have I left on my children up to this point? And sometimes I think I didn't leave much. But 22 years ago, my dad passed away, at the same age that I am. And I have to think about his life, and I know that he taught us some things. I remember one time my dad saying, "We do this because the church tells us to." It wasn't something that was wrong, but it was something that our church did. Do you know that stuck with me all through life? You know, just little words like that, a father telling their son something, can stick to them. In May of 1997, 22 years ago, he died. I'm going to read this poem, which was written by my uncle, which maybe tells a story, and maybe it doesn't tell it as good as I could tell it if I gave more details. The spring of 97, when new life was on the earth, the flowers by the way were bursting forth with mirth. The barren branch upon the tree was boasting now a leaf, and little did we think it time for sorrow, death, and grief. He sacrificed to go along and drive on field trip day. At last the year of school was past, then came the picnic day. And if we never meet again, the children there did sing, although we knew not how the words in reality would ring. This day in May had dawned, a busy day upon the farm. The schedule of the day spoke not of ill or death or harm. The oats and corn were planted, ready now to grow, and only 50 acres of beans were left this day to sow. The sun had risen to its prime. The time was just past noon, and yet life's day was fading fast. Midnight was coming soon. The ones that knew its closing rays saw not an evening glow, nor did the last of words he spoke a final farewell show. The neighbor in the field nearby left him in solitude, and yet the vastness there was filled by God, his fortitude. His angels, too, were waiting by to spare the body. No, they came to bear the soul to where the soul of man doth go. The day of work was partly through. Much seed was left to sow. It seems as if he knew no seed was left for him to sow. Though how and when and why is still to us a mystery, we know in spring there came a call to reap eternally. The man that kept the farm alive, the hand that fed the family, with silent stillness came to rest upon the soil suddenly. A father's heart, a farmer's dream, a wife's security, all wilted like a bitter blight within this tragedy. And this was written 5 years later. And now a half a decade din has muffled some this memory. Yet may we not forget that death can take life suddenly, that like a vapor vanishing, our time on earth will be, and strongest cord of life is but a thread of frailty. And I'll just explain a little bit. Though we still don't know what happened, no one knows what happened. He was planting soybeans on a flat field, and he got to the end of the one side and turned across diagonally across what he had already planted. So something was obviously wrong. No one drives across what they've already just planted diagonally across the field. And he headed back. He wasn't done planting either. He headed back towards the truck, and in the middle, the tractor began to go around in circles and then jackknifed. It was a tricycle tractor, and he was under the fender, but they say that didn't kill him. He was obviously dead before the tractor, or at least unconscious before the tractor flipped. What kind of testimony did he leave? You know, life was gone, and all that he could have done in his life was over. And all that's left is memories. But you know, a week after the funeral, a man knocked on our door, a big burly man. We didn't know him. He said, I'm a neighbor from a couple roads over. And he said, I know you don't know me, but he said, I knew your husband. He said to my mom, he said, I knew your husband. And he said, he was a really good man. He said, here's some money I want to give you. And he gave a $100 check. How many other people were like that? And what about us? What testimony is our life leaving to the people that we come in contact with? My grandmother died 2 years ago. She was 87. She lived a long, much longer life than her son. And at her funeral, sitting on the front bench, were three living sons who were all ministers. Two of her daughters were wives of deacons today. But that wasn't the testimony. Behind them sat 200 descendants. And as I looked across that group of descendants, my mind told me that somebody left an influence. All those sitting there were faithfully serving the Lord. You know, as Grandma was, her mind was going. And she began to do this as she would talk about six things over and over and over again. But one of those things that she would talk about, she'd talk about six things and she'd start over. But the one thing that she would talk about in that track, that one track she'd talk about in those six tracks, was she would always say, all of my children and my grandchildren are conservative Mennonites and they're serving the Lord in many different places. That told you what part of her heart was about. Her heart was about her children and her grandchildren. Now, she didn't know it when she died, but there were two of her grandchildren that weren't serving the Lord. And I don't think anyone told her, and I'm glad that she didn't know either. If she did know, she forgot. But a couple things that she did was she was always interested in her grandchildren's education. She would always ask you about school and ask you what grade you were in. And then for those of us that taught, she would ask us about our school teaching experiences. She was also known to be a stickler for the English language. If we made a mistake in our English, she would correct us. But as life would go on, as we were growing up, she would write letters to us, to the whole family. And she didn't just write about news, but she would write about history, and she would write about people that were influential in her life. She would write about her parents and the things that they did. She was passing along history to us. One time she got remarried at the age of 78, and she told her new husband that if he wanted to marry her, he had to come to her church and he had to move to her house. And we were talking to a great uncle of mine one time over that time about that, and he said, well, that's your grandma. He said, you know, back in the 60s, your grandpa was ready to move to Tennessee with that other group. He said he was ready to move to Tennessee with the other group. And she put her foot down and said, we're staying here. We're going to serve the Lord right where we're at. Now I ask you, was Grandma perfect? Was my father perfect? Were the other people we talked about tonight perfect? No. But it takes each of us to be effective. It takes each of us to do our best in living for the Lord today. Doing what God has for us to do. In the area where he has us to live, and serving him faithfully, passing on to the next generation the values that we know are important to live for the Lord. May God bless you.